I'm Jay Barrett, and you're listening to the Kenai Conversation. This morning we're talking about folks from the Hospice of the Central Peninsula. You know, this morning, I can't remember exactly what it was I was talking about, but I said, you know, it's not something I would do, but I'm glad there's somebody there to do it. And this topic of hospice makes me anxious and such, but I'm glad there are people who are here who can talk about it and tell us all about the organization and what really the folks do and how you can help, really. We have Janice Nightingale. She's the Executive Director of Hospice of the Central Peninsula. Tony Oliver, who is a board member, and Karen Manel, who is a volunteer. Did I get all your names right?
You did.
Oh, terrific. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm glad you guys found the place in good time. I don't know if you've been out here before, but we are tucked away on the Near North Road in the CAPED building. So, Janice, let me start with you. Just tell us what hospice is.
Hospice is not a scary word. With hospice, what we do is we offer families who have someone at the end of their life support in these final days. We help them live life to the fullest, and we help them live with dignity and respect. And our philosophy is not to hasten or postpone death, but to help ease the pain of and the fear of dying.
I have a lot of fear of dying.
Oh.
I don't know. I imagine there are a lot of people, but ever since I turned 50 and went gray, you know, it's just like a specter, you know, over the horizon that now I think about. And it's something that I think a lot of people think about.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you go about easing people into...
Well, we meet people where they're at with our clients and our families. And some people definitely are more fearful, and other people are almost welcoming at the end of a long struggle or a long journey of terminal illness. So we look at each individual family, each individual client, and we meet them where they're at.
Tell me more about that. I mean, where they're at emotionally, you mean?
Emotionally, physically, spiritually, it's the whole gamut of it. Our hospice is a volunteer hospice, so we don't do anything medical. What we do is our volunteers who are well-trained, we offer respite care to the main caregiver, and then we're a buddy and an advocate for the person who is at their end of their life.
I don't know if there's hard and fast rules or, you know, like a list you check off, but how do you know if somebody's at the end of their life? Is this like a doctor's?
It is. We have to have a doctor's referral by state law. And then what we do is once we get the referral, then we meet with the family and see what their needs are and how we can best serve them.
Oh, wow. Wow. How long have you been doing this?
I have been with hospice since September of 2013. I've been the executive director for a little over 2 years. I started out as the administrative assistant and volunteer coordinator.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So you've seen it from every level then?
Yes.
Worked in it?
Yes, yes.
It must work.
It does work.
Yeah, tell us about that. Tell us about, how it works, I guess.
How it works as far as the volunteer program?
How hospice eases people.
Oh, how both hospice eases people.
And you mentioned caregivers as well. Mm-hmm. You know, so how do you ease this process for caregivers and patients and family members and what have you?
Well, our volunteers come in as a calming presence. And so a lot of times, if you can just have someone who is calm in a situation and knowledgeable about what's going on, then it eases some fear. The other thing, when they have fears in their head, once they start to say them out loud, that fear no longer has as much power over them. And so when we have clients who may be very fearful of death and not want to discuss it with their family, but they're very comfortable discussing it with a volunteer who they have developed a relationship with, then that fear doesn't take the power. You know, it doesn't have the power over them that it did before.
Oh, wow. And how does that apply to, or does that apply the same way to caregivers and family members?
It does. Our volunteers also offer the caregivers someone to talk to, someone to vent with, someone who they know they can share things with, and it doesn't go any further than the volunteer. they're not going to go back to their family or to their loved ones and, you know, repeat what they've heard.
Oh, sure, sure. Karen, let me ask you, you're a volunteer, and you are a calming presence. I feel calm.
You feel calm.
How did you decide to do this, and what was your training like?
You know, it was just a draw in a way. I think for the first couple of years that I became aware of the organization, it was because I would see an advertisement in the paper about training. And after a couple of years, I just was always kind of on my mind, I should do that the next time it comes up. And I went to the training. The training is like a 22-hour program that goes over 2 weekends. You get to meet some fabulous people who are willing to talk about anything in this world, and speakers from all different areas that touch something like this. And we shared our own experiences with people passing in our lives and our own fears. A lot of the people in the class, I think, come to the class because they simply want more knowledge. They feel maybe like you do. This is scary, and it's on my mind and on my heart, and I need to know more about it. And they come to learn more. Or maybe they've had somebody pass in their family recently, then it was a hard situation. And they just really need to understand all of a sudden what the heck was going on and what they can do down the road. But you learn a lot, and you get enough confidence with the situation so that when they start sending you out to clients, it's really difficult to explain. All of a sudden you just find, though you never knew this before in your life, that this is something you truly have a passion for. And that if you can just relax a little bit with folks and not be scared, you are going to make some of the best relationships in this short time than you will ever have in your life. The relationship happens immediately. You walk through that door and these people are your best friends. The family, as well as the client, and you are theirs and you belong to them until this situation is over. And you just do everything you can for them. And sometimes, you know, maybe that's doing an errand, and sometimes it's meeting them in the ER because they're panic stricken. Sometimes it's, yes, calming the family down or letting them just discuss things so they know what's normal and what they need to worry about, when they need to take action, and when things are really progressing in the way they should progress, and that they can relax and just go with it. So,
wow.
That's a long answer.
No. It was enlightening. At a time of crisis like that, or I guess an ongoing crisis for a family or something, do you also talk about other things they need to pay attention to? Because I just flashed on, what about funeral arrangements or financial arrangements, wills, and all this stuff?
You know, we're going to talk to them about a whole lot of stuff that they don't know, because you don't find out until you reach a certain stage in your life. And there's a lot of things available, Comfort One agreements with your physician and with the CMS people. There's where they are with their final directives. We call them 5 wishes on the document that we use. Do they want to talk about funeral arrangements? Then we'll talk to them about that, or how they want to see that play out. We learn an awful lot of stuff over the years. We keep running into different things. And so we're one of the good things about a hospice volunteer is we'll talk to you about anything. Okay, we're going to talk to you about when you were 3 years old and you fell in the well, if that's still scary. Or we're going to talk to you about what happened last week. And we're probably going to be the person that you can talk to when you don't want to share certain things with family and friends anymore.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that. Both of my parents died suddenly. That's a blow. All of a sudden, boom, your life changes. I hope this isn't misconstrued in Radioland, I feel lucky, because I've had friends whose parents have lingered for years. And it's drained their families, it's drained their finances, it's caused strife in families. And I don't know where I'm going with that, but I But well, it's something, I guess it's further evidence of mine that I am completely unfamiliar with anything having to do with extended, the tail end of life here. And I think that's part of my curiosity too.
Right. And I think, you know, for this, I would almost reverse that a tiny bit as far as the clients that I deal with for the most part is they actually reach a point where there's a lot of guilt feelings and concerns about the fact that maybe they are thinking this has gone on too long. And maybe it would be a really good thing if mom could just pass tonight. And they feel very badly about that.
Having those thoughts.
It's just our human thoughts. You know, they're trying so hard to do so much and they're exhausted.
Yeah.
And they're stressed beyond belief. And it's a hard time, and I think we certainly are trying to do as much for the family as we are for the client.
I had a friend, and her mom had Alzheimer's or dementia, and lasted for a very long time, and it was a real ordeal. So much so that my friend said, you know, if she ever gets diagnosed with that, she's going to go out on an ice floe and just float away and save her family this trouble. And given that, what is inside of you that makes you wade into that instead of wanting to run away from it?
I honestly have never known outside of the fact that I just started meeting the most wonderful people during the most difficult time, and they are so sharing and so welcoming. You become part of their family in an instant, and they care for you. They're talking to me about what's going on in my life sometimes and what I might use as an option. They're just, as I said, some of the best relationships and closest relationship I've had are relationships that were built over in hospice with people that I just walked through the door and they were willing to trust me, and I was willing to walk the road with them. They sense in you, I think, that you are not going to walk away from them. That you will be there if that's what's needed. And sometimes they want you there toward the end, and sometimes they really want just family. But they know that you will stay there, and you will support whoever needs to be supported. And that hospice as an organization will continue to be involved with family after they're passed, because a lot of people who are passing, they're much more worried sometimes about the people they're leaving than themselves. They know where their life has taken them at this point, and they really need to know that there's going to be somebody for the daughter to call or the son to call.
Oh.
Something like that.
I hadn't thought of that. Wow. Tony, I didn't mean to skip over you here for most of the half hour already, but let me ask you, as a board member, what attracted you to that board, and what do you have to add to some of these topics about, you know, the family and working with them, and the client, the predeceased.
Well, I guess I'd like to say, kind of like those who can do and those who can't teach. Well, I have the same kind of saying about being a board member. Those who can, like Janice and Karen, they do their real work. Those who can't, like me, I'm a board member, and so it's more about nuts and bolts and finances and mission directives and supporting our ED, who can then support her staff. So it's a little different view of hospice from the board side of things. You might say a little less compassionate, but I shouldn't say that, because we have many board members who have been in direct hospice care for years, who are now serving as board members and still serve in the medical community. So we're blessed to have them on board. And so we're kind of a step back from the front lines, if you might say that. So we don't see, just listening to Karen now give me goosebumps, listening to how they interact with families and the kind of issues that come up while they're dealing with families, trying to make sense out of chaos from my perspective. And again, that's kind of why I don't think I can do that. Board member stuff, I'm a little more kind of driven that way. Like I said, numbers and finances and trying to find grants or help them look in directions for grants. We set board policies that RED has to follow. And that's kind of what drew me into it, because I knew I couldn't do the other. At least I don't think I can. Janice keeps telling me I should give it a try. So I'm always amazed at when I listen to them talk about the things they do with families and how they really just become an advocate and a friend to those. And I have seen some of it firsthand. Being a caregiver, in my opinion, is probably one of the hardest things in the world that you can do. And probably the top thing that caregivers do the worst is take care of themselves.
Oh, you know, I've done stories about things like that.
And that's kind of where we come in, and we try to provide some support and some, just get them out the door to have some of their own time. I mean, it's tough enough watching a family member go through this process of death and not have anybody there as a support group.
Sure. Well, Janice, you mentioned you need a doctor's referral,
mm-hmm.
and Karen, you're talking about all the different things required of you. Is there certification or training, you know, to guarantee that someone as good as Karen here is as good you know, how do you do quality control, I guess, is if I could ask it that way?
Well, the training itself, it is 22 hours, like Karen had mentioned, and it's over 2 weekends. So if someone is willing to commit 2 Friday nights and 2 all-day Saturdays, that shows a lot right there. The other thing that we do is our volunteers all have to go through a State of Alaska background check, and then they're fingerprinted and making sure they're all good there. And then they have a TB test and make sure they're healthy there. And so much of being a volunteer, I think, is in your DNA. I think that a lot of people think that they can't do it, but they probably could. I do agree that not everybody can do it. I lost my train of thought where I was going with that. Oh, some people come to our training, and after taking the training, they realize that they're not sure that they can sit by somebody who is at the end of their life. And so what we do is we offer other areas that they can volunteer, either serving on the board or volunteering in the office. So there are other opportunities to volunteer and support hospice. Even if you don't feel at this time, you can be a direct care volunteer. It may be something that you work into.
Sure, sure. How many volunteers do you have that do this?
Right now we have active, I would say 15 to 20 volunteers who are certified and active and ready to go.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
That is way more than I thought. And I mean, it's way more than I thought was would be needed, I think. Are they constantly busy? Or?
Not always constantly busy, but we like to have people on the back burner ready to go when necessary. And it varies throughout the year. I think in December we had, we did intake. Well, our intake is the official form where we go to meet the family. We had, I think, 10 intakes in an 8-day period. It was just, holidays are usually pretty stressful, and that seems to be that time of year where things happen a lot. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Are board members required to take the training as well?
I don't think there's a requirement, but we certainly urge all new board members to take the training. Mm-hmm. And I need to retake it. I was a board member back in the early 2000s with hospice and served a term and came back to it about 5 years ago, and I'm due for a renewal. I keep being told that. But.
Yeah. You know, I've had folks from the Central Potential Hospital Auxiliary on, mm-hmm. and they have a end-of-life support program, mm-hmm. as well. Do you guys work with them at all?
Well, their end-of-life support group is called NODA, the No One Dies Alone program.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
And it is different than hospice. With the NODA program, of which Karen and I both happen to be volunteers for, is separate than hospice. That is a program where somebody is at the last day or two of their life.
Oh.
And so for some one reason or another, there may not be family members or friends that can come sit with them in the hospital or at Heritage Place. And in that case, a NODA volunteer will come out and fill those roles.
Oh, right, right. Yeah. We're talking about hospice here on the Kenai Conversation today. With me are Janice Nightingale, Tony Oliver, and Karen Minnell, all from the Hospice of the Central Peninsula. Regarding the things that volunteers can do and not do, we've kind of gone over the things we can do. What are some of the things that you can't do?
We cannot do anything medical. That means that we cannot administer medications. We cannot do baths for our clients. We cannot transport them to and from places. We can do things, hand massage, feet massage, other areas that would help them feel comfortable, but we don't do anything medical.
So there's a cough drop on the shelf. You can't hand it to them?
We can put it on their tray and they can pick it up.
Now, why is that? Why are some of these, I guess we don't want unlicensed people going around practicing medicine.
Correct.
I understand
correct.
That. But the transportation rule, I don't get that.
That's for insurance purposes. Our insurance wouldn't cover us transporting someone somewhere.
Oh, sure. I hadn't considered. I guess I never consider insurance in how it affects what we do, but there must be more of those kind of limitations from them. Are there, or is it just a huge drain on your budget as well? The insurance premiums.
Well, our insurance premiums, like everyone's insurance premiums, do take a chunk out of our budget. So we try to keep things as. We try to be as fiscally responsible as possible.
Oh, sure.
With the money that, because all of our funds come either through grants, personal donations, or fundraising. Mm-hmm. And so we just want to honor people's giving to our organization and not be overly frivolous with it.
Oh,
or
sure.
Even somewhat frivolous sometimes.
Oh. I've worked in public radio for pretty much all my life, and sometimes we run out of volunteers. Mm-hmm. Some nights we don't have volunteers, or sometimes we're just short of volunteers. I have to imagine that volunteering for something serious like hospice is it easier to recruit or harder to recruit?
Yes.
Oh. Tell me about your process. How do you find people?
We do a lot of advertising through the radio, we do have public service announcements, and through the newspaper in their little community section. We put it out on Facebook, have it on the reader board outside of the office where we're at, and just word of mouth a lot of times. We had gone to one training a year, but found that we really needed to have more of a pool of volunteers. So the last couple of years, we have done two trainings a year.
Oh, do you have, when's the next one coming up?
The next training is the first two weekends in October.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Wow. Do you find that people who have seen hospice working in their family then volunteer or consider volunteering or donate?
Some do volunteer. I think that when you talk to people, when you mention hospice, almost everybody has a hospice story to tell. And so a lot of times when we're out in public promoting the organization, we hear a lot of hospice stories.
Wow. Tell me one.
Tell you one. Well, one of our board members, when her father who was passing, needed a hospital bed. And so they turned to hospice. So that not our local hospice, they were living outside, but it is a hospice story. And so hospice was able to secure this piece of equipment for them so that he could stay at home and be with his wife whenever he passed away.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
And so are you guys involved in those sort of things here in general?
Medical equipment
or facilitating.
Facilitating.
You know, maybe the finding of medical, since you can't do it yourself.
Right. We have a loan closet and where we offer durable medical equipment. We don't have hospital beds anymore. We, quite frankly, don't have the space for it.
I thought you were going to say something, Tony.
I was. I just wanted to throw in there the kind of the piece, and we may be getting to that down the road, but I just wanted to make the distinction. You know, Janice does have two staff members as well working for her directly. One is does admin assistant work and is a volunteer coordinator. The other is our bereavement coordinator. So we do more than just go into homes as well. And you might have been going there, Janice, eventually. But I just wanted to point that out. We do put on bereavement classes for people where their loved one's already passed away and they're trying to deal with the grief process. And we have Tony, who does our volunteer coordination. So she kind of works with all the volunteers and tries to line them up and match them up with clients. And and then the other part of the administrative side that we don't hear so much about with Janice is, it's unbelievable the number of meetings and gatherings that she goes to on a weekly basis, everything from a palliative care committee at the hospital to work with doctors about, I should say, educate them about the needs as far as trying to refer patients who are going to pass soon, trying to make that process happen a little sooner so we can get involved a little sooner.
Oh, right.
Then she sits, I know she sits with a group of nonprofits once a month.
Mm-hmm.
She boggles my mind just listening. I go in and talk to her and I do this and get out of here because I have a meeting to go to.
You're making her blush.
Yeah, that was the purpose. So I just wanted to point out that, you know, we do volunteer. We're in the homes. We provide respite care. Is that the right word?
It is the right word, yes.
Hey, I got a word right.
Good job.
But there's the other part of it that the staff manages as well for after somebody passes, mm-hmm. and for organizing our volunteers. And she's always bringing new stuff to the board. Some of it, a lot of it, she doesn't need to as an ED because she has the authority to do a lot of what she brings to us, but she wants to keep us in the loop. We have a great working relationship with her, and it's a powerful thing.
That's terrific. How many people on your board?
I believe we have 9, 10 now. Mm-hmm. And we're always trying to recruit, so board members are always out trying to recruit board members.
Right.
And I put a pitch out there for any men out there that are interested in sitting on the board, because I believe we offer maybe a different perspective. Currently, I'm the only man on the board.
Wow.
So always trying to encourage other men to get involved with the process.
Yeah, what is the deal with us? I mean, besides you, what is the deal with men not volunteering for things? Because I've noticed that. I mean, it's noticeable.
And I think it's even a tougher pitch for something like hospice because, you know, we're guys and now we're going to talk about our feelings and about being compassionate. And there's a lot of compassionate men out there. So I guess we just need to find them.
Oh, yeah.
I think there are a lot of them out there.
Well, you know, I imagine a good percentage of those listen to public radio. So
I'm hoping.
You know, I wrote when I worked at the Clarion here, and I've worked at several other newspapers over the years. In radio, we don't actually write straight-up obituaries, you know, but at the paper, I've written hundreds of obituaries. And at first, I was very nervous about doing it, you know, as a young reporter. But I have found, and nobody believes me, but I think you're going to believe me, Karen, the bereaved, the family, they love talking about their loved one who's passed.
Absolutely.
And I've never once had somebody say, no, I don't want to talk about that, you know, because if you do a proper obituary, you know, like you see in a big newspaper, you call them up, you talk to them, you find out about this person.
That's right.
Write something more than just who they're survived by.
You know, you're right, and people have lives, and one of the things we do when we're going out and doing like initial intakes is we talk to family and the individual about who they were in their life. What did they do? Where did they live? How many children do they have? Even is the family getting along sometimes? And you sometimes we forget that this is a whole person. They've been here many years, most of them. And they have a history that is unbelievable. I mean, we were dealing with folks that, you know, were shot at by Germans who were German. And I mean, they just, these people bring with such a rich history. It's one of the great things about being able to spend time with them and learn about who they were and what they did and what they accomplished in their life. And yeah, and to have that shared a little bit at the end and a little cut extra words of wisdom, that's great.
Yeah, yeah. Do you guys find that true as well, that the loved ones want to talk about their...
Yes, they do. And one of the things that we offer is after a client passes, we follow up with the family for 13 months with our bereavement program, if they choose to be involved with that. And that's what Lee, our bereavement coordinator, does. It's usually through mailings, but her office is always open. And we do have several family members throughout the year come in just to talk.
Yeah, and you have a program along those lines, right? Bereavement and community program?
We offer throughout the year occasionally grief groups for people who want to work through some grief. We offer presentations on bereavement, especially around the holidays. We have our Camp Mend a Heart. I don't know if you want to get into that now.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay.
It's Camp Mend a Heart.
Camp Mend a Heart is a camp for youth ages 6 through 16 who have experienced a loss in their life. It's a three-day day camp that's held in August. This year, I believe it's the 13th, 14th, and 15th. If we have enough teens, then on the 12th, we'll have a special afternoon for just for the teens. And then all campers, teens and youth alike, will attend the next 3 days. And they do grief groups in the morning and do some grief work, helping them know how to process or learn how to process, not know how to, but learn how to. But then they do a lot of fun things in the afternoon. And at the camp, we offer canoeing and horseback riding and swimming, music, just a lot of fun things. But the biggest thing is the kids get to interact with other children who also have experienced loss.
Mm-hmm. Again, I'm glad there's somebody who does this job, but how hard is it to get young people, boys perhaps especially, to open up like that? Is 3 afternoons enough?
I am always amazed because I think the camp should be a week long just because there's so much that happens during those 3 days that from the first day they walk in to the third day when they leave, the connections that they make and the relationships that they build and what has truly happened in those 3 very short days. It's incredible. It's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Have you had any of those folks over the years turn around and come back and volunteer once they're adults, or has this not been, you don't have a long enough sample?
I think the camp has been going on about 10 years.
Hmm.
And so some of our volunteers maybe, but not that they've spoken up with mm-hmm. about. So
yeah. Wow. Well, let's talk about some of the support. Karen, you're telling me about
right.
the support that you as a volunteer and the other volunteers get from the staff, and that they seem almost clairvoyant.
They do seem a little clairvoyant. I think they get a real sense for us over time, but for anyone who's thinking about volunteering, or that, I just wanted to say that, you know, the support that comes from people like Janice and Tony and Lee in the office is so fabulous. They really have their fingers on the pulse of our moods, and if we're going through a difficult time, if we've lost a client we've been particularly close to, they will really make sure that they'll follow us to make sure that we're in a good place.
Well, that
as,
brings
as
up
thing a, goes along. So it's fantastic that way. You really get what you need as a person in the field
oh,
to
that's
do this
great.
Work.
Well, it's great to have that kind of support yeah. from above, especially if you're a volunteer.
Right. You can go. I mean, really, you can go in anytime. You can text them anytime. You can do whatever you. They will do whatever. Like as the volunteer, you want to do everything you possibly can to support your client and their family. These folks in the office will do absolutely anything to support the volunteer. I know that at any time, if I called Janice and said, I'll get out here right this second, she would be there. And it's just the way. And another thing is with, like you were talking about, with facilitating, did we facilitate a lot? And it's not our major thing in life, but I know that anytime I have a client who has a need, I call the office and I say, this client has such and such a need or needs information on this topic or that topic, and they will go and they will get that information.
Wow. You know, you mentioned about the support, and it struck me. What about the your own emotional health? Because, again, this goes back to just my fears and what have you. But how do you survive that emotional? I mean, it's got to be emotional, right?
It can be very emotional. You're losing somebody that you have been very close to, even if the relationship was close. I mean, was short. I think to a certain degree, you know that that's part of the package. But also, you just need to try to, I think, live as healthy a lifestyle as you can and have interests and friends and other things going on in your life so that things are balanced. Another reason why the office is so critically important is that when I say that, you can't be talking about anything to do with your clients with anybody other than paid hospice workers. So there's a lot of things that yeah, maybe are on your heart that you can't share with anybody normally, not a husband or a wife or friends or anything like that. So they, when they step into that gap, it's really, really important. Because even though you can have a balanced life in a lot of other areas, you might really have a lot of things you need to... go through. People are going through a hard time, and you tend to pick up some of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't mean this to sound flippant, but does hospice provide mental health insurance for its volunteers? You know, if they need to go get a little counseling themselves.
We actually cover self-care during our volunteer training.
Oh.
So this year we had a local counselor come in, and she spent about an hour and a half, 2 hours talking about trauma and self-care and ways to deal with that. And we do, my office door is always, always opened. And like I said, most of the volunteers have our cell numbers that they can call and talk at any time. Our office hours are Monday through Thursday, 10 to 4, but our volunteers... their hours are whenever the client needs them. And so as a supportive director of the organization, I try to be open and available whenever is needed also.
Mm-hmm. Without going into any specifics at all, what's the most interesting or important or crazy call that you've gotten off hours from a volunteer?
Oh. They just needed someone to talk to.
Yeah.
And I did get a call from someone who was on vacation who had gotten a call from somebody who had heard of somebody else. And so it was just kind of a roundabout where we tried to cut out the middleman and get to the gist of what needed to be done and do it.
Mm-hmm. So. Do you, regular training that you do of new volunteers, what's the percentage of people who follow through and become volunteers? You said that some become board members, you know. That
I would say at least 50%.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Could be higher, or do you think that's a good attrition rate, you know, to... Because you know how some people, you know, they get to a point emotionally and they feel like they want to give mm-hmm. help. Mm-hmm. But maybe they're not prepared to, mm-hmm. you know, but yet they try. So, I mean, is your attrition rate acceptable or what's ideal? What's the word I'm looking for?
It's acceptable. We also, Alaska is a very transient state as well. So a lot of our volunteers come do training, volunteer for a year or two, and then move on. Or they travel a lot. And so sometimes in the wintertime, we have a lot of snowbirds. In the summertime, it's summertime in Alaska, and people like to be on vacation and out and about. So that's why we like to have a wide pool to draw from our volunteers.
But, you know, you mentioned Alaska in the summertime here, and, you know, of course, everybody wants to be out and about. Hospice is only for, like, the caring at the end. Well, you can't take them for a drive, so you can't take them down to the boardwalk and watch the river, right?
That is correct. Yeah. However, if they have a family member that can bring them to the boardwalk, our volunteers can meet them there.
Oh, okay. So, yeah. Are you doing things like this? I mean, I guess I'm trying to flesh out the picture of all the possible things that you do and could do, and opposed to, you know, you mentioned there are definitely things you can't do.
Mm-hmm. We actually had a volunteer who met her client at Mackey Lake one time to go kayaking.
Oh, wow.
So it's, some people are more bedridden than others. Mm-hmm. And so, but for the most part, our clients are either in their home or in the hospital or in at Heritage Place or assisted living.
Mm-hmm. How do you work with people who maybe are, you know, just horribly despondent about their own situation or their family member's situation? What do you offer them?
Whatever they ask for. We just sometimes just come and just sit. And sometimes just coming and sitting eventually will lead to a conversation.
So, wow.
Yeah. We have a lot of pamphlets and resources that we can take to somebody's home and offer it to them, read it to them if they want. But a lot of information we leave there and let them read it as they're ready to.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about some of that, the pamphlets and such.
Okay, one of the books that we give to all of our clients is called Final Gifts. And I'm holding up about 3/4 of an inch thick. It's a paperback book. And it talks about the end of life and a lot of good information in there. And then we also use a lot of Barbara Carnes resources. Barbara Carnes is like the hospice nurse guru for many, many years. This year, we were very fortunate to receive a grant from the Kenai Peninsula Foundation, which is an affiliate of the Alaska Community Foundation. Mm-hmm. We received a grant so that we can purchase those resources to give to our clients, so it's not so much of a strain on our budget.
Oh, sure. What is your budget?
Oh, what is it? About $150,000 a year.
You guys need more money.
We do need more money.
How do you guys fundraise?
Well, let Tony speak to fundraising.
Sure, Tony.
Well, our biggest fundraiser, of course, is our annual wine event held in February at the Catholic Church. Their space there, their right. community hall. So it typically draws in, it's our biggest, draws in, I guess it could be anywhere from $50,000 to $70,000 in a night. It's promoted. It makes us all work together. It's incredibly busy for several months, and we've had people from the community step up that aren't on the board, aren't really part of a hospice, that have come in and worked with us, real go-getters. So we put that on every year, and it's typically pretty successful. As a board, we do training as well, so we typically do a 4-acre training at folks at Anchorage, and they try to teach us, board members, stuff we're supposed to know. And they cover everything, including trying to diversify our revenue stream.
Oh, right.
So for years and years, we've been dependent upon the wine event, and it's a great event, and it's not going anywhere. It'll always be here, but trying to add to that by looking for grants, which are getting harder and harder to find. We tried a development, we funded a development position, and out of that came some things like our root beer run in September. We did it first time last year, raised, I think, about $1,000.
Mm-hmm. Oh, how was that?
Pardon?
What was that event?
It was a run walk, I would say.
It was a fun fundraiser.
Uh-huh.
Fun fundraiser, which ended up at the Kenai River Brewery with root beer.
Oh.
That's the root beer run. They make great root beer at the
brewery. Oh, yeah. Well, how far was the run?
I think you could pick from distances, the longest just being a mile. It was all held at the Soldotna Creek Park, so the milers had to do probably, I forget how many laps, like five laps or something.
Right.
A lot of kids, a lot of enthusiastic kids. I think they wanted the root beer.
Mostly. Oh, yeah.
So we did that, and we're always looking at ways to try and diversify as recommended by our business consultant, 4-Acre, to not be reliant upon, you know, any single event for a revenue stream. So we're still working on bringing new ideas to bring revenue in. And it's kind of right now, and we get a lot of money from Pick, Click, and Give. And the hospital funds us every year. And a lot of this I should let Janice talk about because she deals with this every day.
Mm-hmm. You know, fundraising is incredibly hard for nonprofits. We, you know, here at the radio station, we control the airwaves, and, you know, it's still a struggle to bring in even half that much during a fund drive. And we're on the air. You know, we could be wall to wall on the air about this, and it's money is just so tight these days in a lot of sectors. You know, with the agri-implant having closed, and then the I don't know what they call it now, the natural gas plant. You know, there's a lot of jobs, a lot of families who were connected with that. I know were involved in giving in the community, and they're all gone now.
Wow. Now, things have definitely gotten tighter financially, as we've witnessed just by our own state of Alaska budget and how things are going there, and how that trickles down to the local economy. And, yeah, when things get tight, people become more frugal, as they should be.
Yeah.
So it is tougher to find, especially for nonprofits, to bring in revenues.
Yeah. Tell me more about the the fundraising there.
Janice? Oh, the fundraising?
Yeah, that Tony had pointed out before.
The Root Beer Run fundraiser?
Oh, all of them.
Just kind of all in general. First of all, I have to say that we have an extremely generous community. And while we loan out our medical equipment for free to the community, many of our people who use the equipment, and it doesn't have to be one of our clients, it can be anyone from the community who needs, maybe they've had a hip replacement and they need to come in and borrow a walker. Many people do make a donation after using our equipment, and sometimes it's a small donation, but you know, it's like all those small donations all add up. And we have people who donate in memory or in honor of their loved ones. The community is so generous. I can't say enough about it. So.
You know, I see in the paper, going back to obituaries, again, all the time I see them thanking hospice, mm-hmm. Hospice volunteers in their loved one's obituary, you know, about the help that they received from them. Mm-hmm. And it's, once again, it's just incredible to me that that there's people who are willingly doing this job, and I'm glad you're there. We have about 3 minutes. Is there anything you'd like to add about what else you've got up? You mentioned yesterday when we were talking on the phone, you had a summer intern of coming up.
Yes, one of the grants that we receive this year, and we have for the past as many years as I've been there, and probably several years before, is a grant through ExxonMobil. And they fund an 8-week internship, and they give us $2,500 that all is used for the intern's wages throughout the 8 weeks. And so we have interviewed many wonderful candidates, and we're going to actually be making that decision today as to who we're going to hire for that position.
Are these college kids?
The requirements is that the intern be enrolled in high school or in college to continue their education. But it's amazing when these young people come in to apply for the internship, the amount of talent and what these young people are doing, it's going to be really, I lose sleep over making this decision.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, boy, I tell you, there's a generation coming up now that is sharp as I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. You know, I imagine people say that about all generations, but I don't know. I've worked with a lot of young volunteers in radio over the years, and I'm very impressed. Mm-hmm. And my old age may be in good hands. I don't know. Tony, any last words? We got a minute or two for you here.
Other than, you know, spreading the praise around again for our volunteers and our hospice staff, they do a job that. I know Janice once or twice has told me that they've talked to people that have been referred to hospice and literally turn around running away saying, you know, I'm not ready to die yet, because our name is kind of associated with the death process. So I don't know if we scare people off, but these folks, they make it seem like it should be. Like a compassionate, dignified process that it is. Mm-hmm. And that's the coolest thing.
Wow. Karen, any last thoughts?
Yes, just to build on one thing Tony had to say there. If you have a family member or if it's you and you're falling into this situation where you're going to be needing some help, please don't wait until you think you're going to be gone next week. Call us early. Let us build a relationship with you. Let us be a help to you early on. Let us help your family early on, so that, you know, we're all taking this road together toward the end, and we can provide so much more value if we can spend a number of months with you instead of a week or things like that. I mean,
that sounds like a whole conversation I should have asked about a half an hour ago about when you enter people's lives. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. Normally not soon enough.
Oh, so, yeah. So. Well, my guests have been Janice Nightingale, the Executive Director of Hospice for the Central Peninsula, Tony Oliver, who is a board member, and Karen Minnell, who is a volunteer. It's been wonderful having you people here. My anxiety level about hospice and end-of-life things is much lower now, thanks to all of you. And I really appreciate you coming in.
Thank you.
You're listening to listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL, 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.